Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
And now on ABC Radio National, it's time for Counterpoint, an hour of opinion and discussion with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
Hello and welcome to the program. Today we present one of the more challenging interviews in our brief history. British scientist Terence Keeley is going to propose to you that there'd be more innovation if governments stopped funding science.
Also today, a look at the growing move to bring Aboriginal kids to city boarding schools and a defence of Enid Blyton, whose books still sell about 7 million copies a year.
And Big Ears grinned. You're the best friend a fellow could wish for. Noddy smiled. They were both very happy that everything was right again.
More on Noddy, Big Ears and Enid Blyton later today on Counterpoint.
Now, Terence Keeley is an organic chemist and Vice-Chancellor of Buckingham University in Britain. We've had him on the show before, and now he's written a new book called Sex, Science and Profits.
The book's ultimate argument is that government should stop funding science, but he approaches this through a history of innovation, in which he looks at when major breakthroughs occurred, and then he asks, why did they happen at certain times and not at others?
Well, the answer is that the freer the market and the more rigorous a market is protected in terms of property rights and freedom from taxation, so that the market is as free as possible. The freer the market, the greater the competition, the more people invest in research and development so that they can outstrip their competitors, and so research and technology advance in free markets.
That's an argument that some of us would be familiar with, but what I find fascinating about your book is the detail, how we go through history, and quite a lot of history. So let's do that. Let's start with the Stone Age, which began over 2.5 million years ago. Why did the Stone Age end?
Well, as I said in the book, it didn't end because we ran out of stones. The Stone Age ended, it's a very nice question, because, of course, we moved into the beginnings of the various metal ages, the Bronze Age, to be precise. The Stone Age was a very, very good age for humans because we had the New Stone Age Revolution, and that was around 10,000 years ago. It came to an end about 10,000 years ago in the area we call the Middle East. And what had happened was that people then, living in small tribes, fairly democratic as far as we can work out, fairly free to experiment, had developed an extraordinary range of technologies. They'd invented ploughing and almost all the crops and food animals, that, you know, sheep and cows, all those things were developed in the New Stone Age Revolution. Almost all the crops we still use, lentils even, were developed in the New Stone Age Revolution. Even the business of sowing fields with nitrogen-fixing plants. All these things developed in the Stone Age Revolution. And the Stone Age Revolution was a fantastic time for humans. But unfortunately, with the development of agriculture, so that humans were no longer hunters, but were now sitting on a piece of land, they became extremely vulnerable to predators, i.e. kings and emperors. And the New Stone Age Revolution, which was a wonderful time for humans, ended about 10,000 years ago thereafter, with horrible people such as the pharaohs in Egypt or the kings of Assyria and all the other monsters one reads about in the Old Testament, who basically exploited ruthlessly the peasants, the way, for example, peasants have been exploited until very recent times in Tsarist Russia or even communist China.
But the invention of agriculture, that itself required some considerable leaps forward from the state of being a hunter-gatherer, didn't it? I mean, the acquisition of property rights or the concept of property rights.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, the concept of property rights absolutely did evolve and emerge with agriculture. But the reason we developed agriculture, it's a very sad story. People used to believe, you know, when you and I were at school, we were told that agriculture was a great leap forward. But in fact, we now know that the reason we developed agriculture was that particularly in Asia, and it's a very modern story of ecological damage, the hunter-gatherers of the time had simply hunted all the animals to near extinction. people were starving 10,000 years ago in the Middle East and in Asia, where most of these new cultures emerged, including, of course, in China and India. And all these cultures had to move towards agriculture because they'd hunted the animals to near extinction. So, yes, with agriculture, humanity is saved again because we develop property rights, because it's almost clear that once you have a piece of land, that's your land. You know, it's almost embedded in the concept of being a farmer. But almost the moment that the farmers developed property rights and developed agriculture, then almost immediately afterwards, very sadly, the predators and emperors and kings moved in and basically just exploited people ruthlessly.
And what did that do for technological development?
It stopped it entirely. You look at ancient Egypt as a classic example. You can go to Egypt and you can see temples and pyramids and tombs, and over a 3,000-year period, it's a very dramatic thing because it's still there, over a 3,000-year period, absolutely nothing changes. There's not a single technological innovation in 3,000 years. And that's the story that you see spreading throughout all the Bronze Age empires, the Chinese and in India. You see an initial burst of activity in the new Stone Age revolution until the kings and emperors take over, and then they just maintain large armies of men whose job it is to go around beating up the peasantry, extracting food from them, and doing absolutely nothing to encourage economic or technological growth, because of course it's not in their interest to do so. They just want to feed off the peasants.
As you say that, I mean, it's quite extraordinary, isn't it? 3,000 years of just nothing much happening in our terms anyway. If we go back 3,000 years from today in our civilization, so much has happened.
Absolutely. In fact, some civilizations go backwards. The Japanese, classic example, the Japanese, this is a story of the 16th century, when they first discover pistols and gunpowder and modern armaments that are brought to them by the Portuguese, the Dutch and the British, for a short time, Japanese adopt these technologies, and then very quickly the samurai realize that these are very democratic technologies. They allow a peasant to shoot an aristocrat, and very quickly Japan absolutely forbids all firearms or gunpowder at all to maintain this feudal society. You see the same in China. China also banned, by the way, the use of gunpowder for anything other than fireworks, and for nearly 1,000 years there was no development in China. So actually, in a strange sort of way, economic growth, which has only really happened over the last 250 years, is a very recent human phenomenon. I mean, the story of humanity really is a story of kings oppressing peasants and of absolutely no economic or technological development. That is a story of humanity. It's only every now and then you get these bursts of economic growth. They're very temporary and they're very fragile, apart from, I hope, the current one.
Mm. So what happened in the Bronze Age to shake up these long-running empires you were talking about and get technology moving again?
Well, what happened, and actually this is rather interesting, it's described in the Bible of all places, what happened is that the big empires were absolutely sterile hellholes, but you get little groups of people like the Israelis, the Hittites, the Philistines, and other small peoples, and they trade between the big empires, and they're often protected because they trade by sea, and sea is very hard to police and very cheap to travel. And so, for example, it's the Philistines who came up with the Iron Age. It wasn't the huge empires of the Bronze Age that invented how to develop iron. It's these tiny little peoples in the Middle East called the Philistines who do that. And if you read the Old Testament, you actually see very interestingly people like Abraham actually negotiating with Hittites to buy a piece of land for a piece of silver so that he can bury his wife there. And we see here trade and property rights. But if you were in Egypt of the day, you weren't allowed to have silver because that was actually something that ordinary people were not allowed. There was no money in ancient Egypt because money empowered people. There were no property rights in ancient Egypt because that empowered people. So it's these small trading peoples, such as the Philistines or the Hittites or the Jews, who make the huge technological discoveries, and including, of course, reading and writing, which were these small trading peoples. And from there, you get technological development that in the end allows these small peoples to resist the big empires and create their own empires until they themselves, of course, then decay.
Okay, so but what is it about the small trading people that enabled them to make these technological advances?
That's a very good question, because it goes to the heart of technological advance. If you've got a group of Jews, a group of Hittites and a group of Philistines competing to transport wood or copper or whatever to one empire or another, and these merchants are competing with each other, they will actually engage in research and development actually on the job. They'll actually try to find ways of making their ships sail faster or sail better or sail more cheaply than their competitors. So what drives these small trading nations to make the technological advance is quite simply competition. It's the inevitable and perennial story. Only through competition, the mother of necessity, do people actually turn to innovation. But they're doing it because they're looking for profit.
Okay, and once they have the innovation, they come up with products or whatever that in some cases make them superior to other people, so that in a sense is a reward. And this posed a threat to those huge static empires you talked about, which eventually crumbled.
That's exactly right. The trouble is, of course, that you can still produce a wonderfully rich civilization and yet still fall to one of these big empires. I mean, take, for example, what happened in the Mediterranean with the Iron Age. You get the Iron Age and you get fantastic economic development outside Assyria, outside Egypt, outside the big empires. And the Greeks in particular, very commercial people, the Greeks. They've got colonies everywhere, they trade everywhere. And the Greeks, unusually, don't have in the centre of their towns, in the Agora, they don't have a king's palace. They don't have a huge temple. What they have is a marketplace. And so the Greeks, almost for the first time in human history, surrounded by these ghastly empires, they have in the centre of their towns a marketplace where people can trade. And, of course, it's based on democracy, because democracy produces markets and markets foster democracy. But what happens, of course, is the Macedonians, who are savage, much more primitive people, come down, beat up the Greeks, and then after that the Romans come along and crush all technological innovation. We forget that the Roman Empire was technologically dead. It did nothing technologically for nearly 1,000 years. And so the tragedy is that you can be a small country and be rich in terms of GDP per capita, but if there's a huge empire around the corner, it may be much poorer than you in terms of GDP per capita. But GDP in toto can be much bigger because you have these armies of thugs and they can come and beat you up and take away your wealth. So all the time, these small commercial countries are vulnerable to these huge monolithic empires. And indeed, the Roman Empire, when that died, you were left with a Europe that was completely the Dark Ages, where basically, until the Dark Ages took over, funnily enough, but the Roman Empire itself was technologically dead. It was a nightmare place.
Well, this is a very interesting point, because these days, the conventional view is that the Roman Empire was a wonderful creative period followed by the Dark Ages when nothing happened. But you have a different view of the Dark Ages, don't you?
It is exactly the other way around. The Roman Empire, which of course is a slave empire, lived only for military thugs beating up slaves and foreign peoples. And basically, when it was a plunder empire. And when it ran out of plunder, it died. Whereas the Dark Ages were a time of enormous commercial creativity and technological creativity. The Dark Ages invented the crank, for example. It's all very well having a wheel, but you can't turn a wheel into any other form of motion. And you can't transmit linear motion to a wheel unless you have a crank. That was invented in the Dark Ages. And if you look at all the things that were invented in the Dark Ages, soap and trousers, to name trivial things, but also really important things like locks of canals. Canals were built in the Dark Ages, and locks were invented at the time so that boats could go up and down. Huge advances in sailing technology, the invention of what we can now call lateen sails, but of course that's a sail that enables you to tack up and down. That was a Dark Age discovery.
It's fascinating, isn't it, that these were things that this great classical period of the Roman Empire, despite all its apparent glories, hadn't managed to come up with.
There was no incentive. If you're the Roman emperor and some blasted merchant somewhere comes up with a superior form of, say, a sailing boat, well, his sailing boat might be able to outstrip your tax-collecting boats, and so they may avoid paying tax to you. If you're an emperor, you've got no interest in your merchants or your middle classes flourishing. All you want to do is tax them to the hilt. Slave empires never produce technological innovation. They kill everything, including innovation.
The Dark Ages were also quite good for agriculture, weren't they?
The Dark Ages, thank you for reminding me, the Dark Ages were fantastic for agriculture, because it's in the Dark Ages that the first time we see people going from a two-field rotation, which was the new Stone Age discovery, that you could have crops one year and then lying fallow the other. In the Dark Ages, you know, 800 AD, when everyone assumes until recently, all this is relatively recent scholarship that's been rediscovered in a sense, but in 800 AD, you actually see people, particularly around the Paris region, the Belgium region, basically that area of northwest Europe, the France, Flanders region, they invent three-field rotation. And they, you know, until 800 AD, it's incredible. The Romans didn't know how to use horses. So the Romans, for example, didn't know how to put a horse in front of a carriage, because the moment that horse pulled, it strangled itself, because the only thing the Romans knew what to do was to put a rope around the neck of the horse. But in 800 AD, they invent a harness so the horse can pull without strangling itself. In 800 AD, they invent horseshoes so that the horse can actually become much more useful than that. And they invent saddles and stirrups. The Romans did not have stirrups. Can you imagine how ignorant and stupid that all was? All these things came out of the Dark Ages, when people actually started owning their own land again, they started trading again, and they started inventing new technologies such as three-field, three course rotation or using horses sensibly so that instead of strangling your horse when it pulled your plough, and of course they invented ploughs, much better ploughs, your horse could actually pull without dying of strangulation. All these were Dark Ages discoveries, all these overlooked by the Romans.
Did this occur in the Dark Ages because there was more freedom, more markets, more competition, as you said earlier, about a different period?
Exactly. What happened is that what the Dark Ages represent, in a sense, it's a return to the New Stone Age. Europe became full of these small little tribes, really, occupying a valley here or a mountain there or a river bed somewhere. And these small tribes become much freer than the Roman Empire. Because when you have a small group of people sitting in a valley somewhere, they tend to run themselves in a reasonably democratic way. And because that is the late... If you read Tacitus, for example, who wrote 2,000 years ago, Tacitus makes the point that the Roman Empire was a brutal tyranny when no one was free, but the Germans, he wrote a book called Germanica, the Germans had democracy, they had the rule of law, they had trial by jury, they had a separation of powers, they even gave women political rights, some of the tribes, which he thought was terrible. But the point was, he made the point the Germans, in a more primitive state, were democrats in a way that the Romans were not. And so with the collapse of the Roman Empire, people re-established themselves in these small tribes, and the Holy Roman Empire was fairly benign at that point, basically leaving people alone. And so the natural instinct is to trade. I mean, if you have a farmer here and a fisherman there, the natural instinct is the farmer to trade with the fisherman. And so you get trade developing, fish, crops moving one way or the other. And so gradually you get markets developing, you get towns developing as centres of trade rather than as centres of parasitism. And so people have an incentive to sow more crops, to try to get the horses more effective because your markets have grown again.
In Britain, in the 17th and 18th centuries, we see what are known as the scientific, the agricultural revolutions. Often they were pretty much the same thing. What was going on then? Why did they occur then? How were they related to political changes or to market changes?
The reason the agricultural and industrial revolutions take place in England can be explained by one fact and one fact alone, the Glorious Revolution of 1688. Before 1688, in England, or indeed almost anywhere in the world, if the king, the Stuart king, the Tudor king, if he liked what you had on your land or your house or your shop, he just came along and took it. And so trade was constantly being disrupted and bankrupted by evil predators. But in 1688 and 1689, we have the Glorious Revolution in England, and we have for the first time, actually in human history, bar a little thing going on in Switzerland and Iceland, but forgetting those two because those are marginal countries, for the first time in history in a major country, you get parliamentary government, you get separation of powers so that be ever so high, the law is above you, so that all commercial conflicts go to a court of law, and the court of law is strictly neutral, cannot be bribed or corrupt, and makes a judgment in the interest of the law. So every man, his house is his castle, is protected, and his property rights are absolutely protected. So suddenly, after 1689 in Britain, your property rights are protected, trade is free, there are no taxes, all the state does is to stop basically brigands, and your property is protected. Under those circumstances, people start to invest in companies and banks and farms and factories, because if you make a profit, you can keep the profit. No one steals it from you. And so out of this political settlement of 1689, England becomes the richest country in the world, hugely rich compared to everyone else, with the agricultural and industrial revolutions, because people are free to invest in their own commercial enterprises, and they trade, and they do.
Here on the Counterpoint program, our guest is Terence Keeley, Vice-Chancellor of Buckingham University. We've been talking about the history of technological discoveries. Let's now look at what this history tells us about the relationship between science and technology. Terence, many people believe that technological progress follows in the footsteps of scientific discovery, but that's not the story you're telling, is it?
No, it's a completely untrue story. It was Adam Smith, actually, who 225 years ago pointed out already that the story was just a myth. In fact, it's generally science that flows out of technology. It was Francis Bacon, who was a very great thinker, of course, who in 1605 assumed falsely, he got it wrong, that science needed to be funded by government, which led to technology, which led to economic growth. But if you look on the ground, actually look at how technology actually develops in reality, it almost always comes out of industrial developments, building on previous industrial developments. And then as much as there's a relationship between science and technology, it's as much that technology produces science as the other way around. And even in those cases where science does feed into technology, until very recently, science was, of course, funded by the market, not by the state. And you can see, and it's very easy to show, that the market is very good at funding science, contrary to myth, in as much as it needs to feed its own economic development. But generally, it's the technology producing science. But certainly, the linear model, government money, science, technology, economic growth, is simply a myth. Everyone agrees this is a myth now, but people are also increasingly accepting that it's technology that leads to science generally, and moreover, and this is not so widely accepted, so here I have to warn you that I'm saying something that's not widely accepted, though I think the evidence is overwhelming, by the way, that governments need to fund neither.
Just going back to that relationship between science and technology for a moment, I think one of the nice details in your book, I think you say, don't you, somewhere that at the time of its invention, James Watt's steam engine disobeyed the laws of physics as they were known then?
Absolutely. It's a very good example. And the physicists of the day were startled. And so what they had to do was they had to catch up with what the engineers were already showing. And it's the laws of thermodynamics. And they had to rewrite the laws of thermodynamics. And Carnot, who rewrote the laws of thermodynamics, actually called his book The Science of What They Call Fire Engines, The Science of Steam Engines. So the steam engine came first, and then the thermodynamics came afterwards. But it's the same throughout. I mean, if you want to look at radio astronomy, for example, radio astronomy came out of the Bell Labs when they were developing technology for telephony, and they then won the Nobel Prize for that, and they also won another Nobel Prize, the Bell Labs, for the discovery of the background microwave radiation from the Big Bang. And the more you look into history of technology, the more, and science rather, how often molecular biology came out of applied bacteriology. So it goes on and on and on. Science comes out of technology actually more than the other way around.
I mean, these days, so much government money goes into science in so many parts of the world and into R&D more generally that it is very hard to disentangle this, which I think is the benefit of the longer story that you've told us today about the history of this. I mean, it just provides proof, doesn't it, that markets produce these changes in technology, which then sometimes influence the science.
Certainly my story of history does all that, but more to the point, there's also a modern story of the economics profession. And I quote extensively in the book from that 2003 book produced by the OECD. This is the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. This is the great governmental international think tank. This isn't me. And in 2003, they showed, although, and I say this modestly, I'm not trying to make a cheap point here, I was actually the first to show this, but the point is the OECD have done it much more comprehensively than I ever could have done, that every time a government somewhere puts in a dollar into R&D, and we're talking either pure science or applied science, but so we call it R&D, every time a government puts in a dollar, the private sector takes away $1.25, i.e. nothing more damages economic growth than the government funding of R&D. The OECD spelt this out absolutely clearly, but of course no one wants to know because it doesn't satisfy any vested interests, and so the whole book is almost disappearing, but for my desperate attempts to rescue it.
Well, I mean, Terence, what about the claim that one hears so often that science these days is just so complex that it requires vast sums of public funding and coordination to do it?
Well, I mean, let me put a counter case. It'd be like saying that no one apart from governments would do anything as complex as trying to abolish malaria from the world, except that the Bill and Melissa Gates Foundation in America is putting more into the eradication of malaria worldwide than any government's doing. And if you look back until very recently when governments didn't fund science, you actually saw, in terms of shares of GDP and all the rest of it, organizations such as the Carnegie Foundation and other huge charities pouring the equivalents of vast sums into astronomy or molecular biology. The evidence is that science is very complicated, that's for sure, but so is the modern market. You only got to have a subprime crisis in Iowa, and down in Sydney, people suddenly find their mortgages going up. We live in an extraordinarily interrelated and complex world, and science is just one aspect of it. But that is absolutely no justification for the government funding.
So you'd stop all government funding of science tomorrow if you could?
No. Governments should do nothing suddenly, because we always know that's a mistake. What I would do, actually, is I would freeze all budgets at the current level so that as inflation gradually takes over, so these budgets become smaller and smaller and smaller. And for the evidence of the OECD and the evidence of history is that what would happen is that industry would take up the slack and fund more and more R&D, and that rich philanthropists would take up the sort of cultural slack of funding the sort of science that has absolutely no economic benefit. And you would see rich people like Bond. I mean, if Bond can create Bond University, Bond equally, or a similar type person, could create an observatory or a molecular biology lab, and indeed would do so. You've got the Murdoch Molecular Biology Labs in Australia even today, run by my friend Bob Williamson. And the evidence is that the less government funds, the more the private sector does it, and more generously.
What about non-financial government involvement in science? I'm thinking particularly about patents. Do you support patents?
Patents are a conspiracy against the public. Patents should be abolished. With the exception of the pharmaceutical industry, which is a very exceptional industry, which we could talk about, I talk about in the book. But other than that, patents are a complete scandal. And let me give you an example of why patents are such a scandal. When the Wright brothers invented the airplane in America, they patented it. And no one in America was able to fly an airplane because the Wright brothers simply sued them and brought the whole of the American airplane industry to a halt. And when America finally joined the First World War, 3 years behind the rest of us, in 1917, they found they didn't have an airplane industry. And so in 1917, the Congress abolished, or rather technically made a patent pool, but basically abolished all patents in American aviation. And so America became a patent-free zone for aeroplanes and all associated technologies until 1975. By 1975, guess which country was the world's leading aerospace, aeronautical, aeroplane-building country? America, in the complete absence of patents. And then Nixon, for ideological reasons, reintroduced patents in 75. We can talk about that in some other way. But the point is, all the empirical evidence. People take out patents to stop competitors. That's why they take out patents. And so the whole point of patents is to inhibit competition. And the one thing we know is the only reason people invest in R&D is because they're terrified of the competition. So they only invest in R&D if they fear the competition is going to overtake them. The more the competition, the more they invest in R&D. The less the competition, and patents are designed to stop competition, the less they invest in R&D, and the poorer we all become.
Terence, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because the line's about due to drop out, but this has been a wonderful conversation. Thanks very much again for joining us on Counterpoint.
A real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Terence Keeley is an organics chemist and Vice-Chancellor of Buckingham University, and we've been talking about his new book, Sex, Science and Profits, that's published by William Heinemann.
You're listening to Counterpoint on Radio National. Still to come, Enid Blyton, revisited by Australian expert Tess Livingston, and practical reconciliation. We find out what one Sydney private school is doing.
In the last years of the 20th century, African unity failed.
At one time, the majority of the leaders of the OAU were not been elected. It became a club of dictators.
In 2002, that all changed.
The African Union promises to deliver greater democracy and prosperity.
Has the African Union lived up to its promise? Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.
Let's say a few words about the proposal for a federal government ethics commission.
I like ethics.
The more the better, Michael. But this proposal, in today's press, it says the Rudd government could move to establish a federal ethics commission, an FEC, that sounds good.
Fabulous.
That would have powers to investigate misconduct and also provide training and advice to MPs and public servants. Now, Michael, that's all very well, but I wonder what sort of language an FEC, a Federal Ethics Commission, would use.
Well, I hope it'd be Rudd-speak, Paul.
Well, it would be Rudd-speak, but I can give you the inside drum on Rudd-speak. According to the Fairfax Press, there's a gentleman by the name of Baden Yunson. He's at Monash University. He's completing a PhD in plain English and jargon. Now, that's we need that. He'll get a job for life. But the Fairfax story continues. One of Yunson's favourite tools is what is known as the Flesch-Kincaid grade level formula. Now, Michael, I know that sounds like a punk rock band.
Sounds like the Fog Index.
Well, it's a bit like the Fog Index, but in fact, this program calculates how many years of formal education one needs to understand certain phrases, speeches or written texts.
We should give it a test.
We can, and in fact, the student has done this with a Kevin Rudd. So I'll quote from Kevin Rudd.
Here we go.
The Prime Minister says, there has to be a greater synergy between, let's call it our policy leadership in this, which has been focused so much legitimately on targets, and global architecture, almost reverse engineered, back to the means by which you can quickly deliver outcomes.
He's lost me.
Michael, I don't have a clue what that means, but I can tell you that on the flesh, Kincaid program calculation, to understand that, you need 18.5 years of education, postdoctoral or better.
Well, no wonder this government's so much in favour of higher education.
We're going to need it just to understand what they're bleeding talking about here.
All right, you're listening to the Counterpoint program on ABC Radio National. Paul, where to next?
Michael, it's a story about practical reconciliation that works.
On Radio National, you're listening to Counterpoint with Paul Comrie-Thompson and Michael Duffy.
St. Joseph's College, Hunters Hill, is a 125-year-old Sydney private school.
Now, John Olsen, the painter, went to Joey's, Paul. Did you know that?
Michael, I can't say that I did know that, but what I do know is this. 10 years ago, an Aboriginal student from Walgett in the central west of New South Wales was invited to attend the school, and that started a program that has blossomed. Today, 44 boys, 6% of boarders, are Aboriginal, and there are day students as well. Now, to tell us about how this Indigenous program works, our guest is Andrew Penfold, who's chair of the committee responsible for raising money for this initiative. Andrew, what's the underlying approach of the school and how are the students selected?
Yeah, it's a fundamental thing about some of these programs in terms of different approaches. And the one that I've sort of looked at most carefully is this one where the school leads the initiative. And the important thing is there that the school has actually got sort of skin in the game, that, you know, if there's a difficulty or something goes wrong or they need someone to talk to, it's a direct relationship between the school and the community. And the school's kind of not outsourcing that responsibility to somebody else to deal with. And I think the issue is when the school has got that skin in the game of making sure that they own the outcome and that they have got responsibility for making sure that it's successful, they're much more likely to actually get a successful outcome because they're directly involved in doing that. In terms of the selection criteria, as to your other part of the question there, the children are basically chosen on three really simple criteria. The first is need. So, you know, this is targeted at kids who are in economic need because of the circumstances that they have been born into. The second is enthusiasm. And that means enthusiasm both from the student but also from the parents and the family and the community as well. You know, you're not going to succeed if you don't have enthusiasm and the real desire to take the opportunity. And then the third one really is a much more sort of subjective assessment, which is this child likely to prosper and succeed in this particular school environment? So a child that will succeed in a school like Joey's, for example, may not be suitable for another school and vice versa. So it's all about understanding, is this child the sort of child that will actually succeed and be able to make the most of this opportunity?
Now, following up on your point about relationship with communities, almost half of your students are from a small number of communities, aren't they? I think there's five that are prominent.
That's right. So if you look at all the communities, in the last 10 years, there's been 69 students come through this program. That includes the 44 that are there now, plus the 17 that have graduated in the last 5 years from finishing year 12. Amongst that group of students of 69, they come from about 33 different communities all around New South Wales. But as you point out there, the vast majority come from the sort of central west area of Walgett, Moree, Dubbo, Bourke and Barrowville, actually up on the New South Wales north coast. The interesting thing here is that these are communities where boarders and country kids have been coming down to Joey's for 100 years. So they're communities where the school's got very long-standing relationships and networks of, you know, the local primary school teachers, lots of alumni and parents and people who know the school and have got good relationships through those schools.
So you've got old boys living in those communities.
Definitely, yeah, yes. In all those communities. You go to you'd be hard to find any country town in New South Wales where there wasn't some Joey's old boys, but certainly that area out in the central west and northwest of New South Wales is a very big catchment area for the Joey's enrolments.
Andrew Penfold, a criticism might be raised by some that you're bringing kids in from communities in the west of New South Wales. They're coming to the Big Smoke, they're getting an education, that this might result in them having a diminished understanding of themselves as Aboriginal people. Is that your experience?
No, it's certainly not. I mean, I think if that criticism were to come to anyone, I'd say, first of all, that they're quite ill-informed about the evidence and the reality and the facts. You know, it's easy to throw around colourful rhetoric, but the facts and the evidence actually point to a very different conclusion. You know, I think it was Chris Sara recently said, Dr. Chris Sara, who's an educationalist in Queensland, said the more you educate an Aboriginal child, the more you strengthen their Aboriginal identity. And that's certainly borne out by the evidence of what's happening at St. Joseph's. We have examples, you know, Indigenous kids that have come down from places like Walgett and Bourke and Dubbo and Moree, they're not told that they need to go out and become Aboriginal leaders. They developed an instinctive sense of wanting to do something to contribute to provide solutions for their own people, and they're doing this themselves. So we've got Aboriginal kids, we've had 17 that have left in the last 5 years in terms of finishing year 12, who are now at university and TAFE and jobs and all sorts of things, but they're all engaged in Indigenous reconciliation and advancement in some sense.
Now, you have a number of profiles of old boys in your annual report. Tell us about Craig Ashby.
What's his story? He is one of the most inspirational young men I've ever met, whether they're Indigenous or not. He was age 15, living in Walgett with his nan. His mother had died when he was very young, and he hadn't spent much time with his father. And he couldn't read or write. He was 15, and he went and saw the local priest in Walgett and said, you know, he'd seen all the boys getting off the bus in their blazers and their ties, and thought, that looks pretty good. I'd like to have a look at that myself. So I went and saw the local priest and asked, how do I get involved in that? The local priest said, well, you know, I'll make a few phone calls for you, and then brought him down to Sydney to meet Joey's. He was 15 years old, could not even write his address. That was in year nine. That was in 2002. 4 years later, 2005, he's finished his high school certificate. He's now in his third year at Sydney University studying to become a school teacher, and he's just getting absolutely brilliant results, credits and distinctions, and he's just an inspirational young man. He's speaking at events all of the time, addressing reconciliation assemblies and forums, all sorts of cultural events. He's working with Father Chris Riley, Youth Off the Streets. He's working in a little school in Redfern as a teacher's aide. He's actually at a school this month in Glebe, St. Scholasticus there in Glebe, doing his one-month practicum in the classrooms, talking about teaching kids about history and Aboriginal rights, and rights as in R-I-T-E-S, rites of passage. And he's just an inspirational young man. Now, you know, in his own words, if he didn't have this opportunity, he'd be in Walgett, lying under a tree like a cow, drinking wine.
And just to go back to the beginning, it was him who went to the local priest and said, I want something better. That's how it all started.
Exactly. So this is going back to the enthusiasm of kids to want the opportunity and to having the support. You know, part of the reason he had the interest in approaching the priest was that he saw other kids getting off the bus in their school blazer, and he saw them running around town in their footy jumpers and started asking questions. So what this has done, it's not just educating those particular kids who get the opportunity to go to boarding school. It's actually putting hope and aspiration into young kids in country towns like Walgett and Bourke and Dubbo, who now see this opportunity and understand that education is a really important, you know, part of life, and that it's actually achievable for them to have a big dream to get a good education.
I mean, Craig Ashby's experience would be a classic example of practical reconciliation.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, you can talk about all the other things that you like, but in terms of what actually works and what happens on the ground, I've not seen anything more effective than this.
I was struck, thinking of current students, and I'll just use a first name here, of a student, Andrew from Redfern. How has his life changed?
Quite amazing. He was attending, he's just started his first year of year 7 last year, just moved into year 8 this year. And he's actually been the recipient of a scholarship from the late Father Ted Kennedy from Redfern and Mum Shirl. So some of the people associated with Mum Shirl and Father Ted put a scholarship in place so that we could have a pathway for kids from Redfern who wanted this opportunity to come into school. You know, Andrew, you talk to him, he had never done any homework in his life. Or if he did, it was a few hours here and there a year. You know, he's now doing 2 hours of study every night. He's doing very well in his schoolwork, and he's very good at sport as well, and he's really loving the opportunity and really fitting in well at school.
Andrew, we're nearly out of time. In summing up what you've experienced, I'm 20 years in law and banking, and now you're working with the St. Joseph's College Indigenous Fund. Has your experience convinced you that with Indigenous education, the initiatives have to be school-led?
Yes, very much so. I mean, you know, different things work in different places, but the model I've seen that works very well is where schools take the initiative to actually get stuck in and do these things themselves, rather than sort of having someone else bring kids into a school and say, hey, this is a good idea, why don't you do it? The school needs to have the leadership involved, it needs to have the staff involved, it needs to have, you know, a fully structured program within the school. It's not just about how do we find some Aboriginal kids to come into the school.
Andrew Penfold, thanks for talking to Counterpoint.
Thank you very much.
Andrew Penfold, Chair of the Committee responsible for raising money for the Indigenous program at St Joseph's College, Hunters Hill in Sydney.
And you're listening to Counterpoint. In just a moment, we look at the current state of the reputation of Enid Blyton, one of the most popular authors of all time.
The ABC Fiction Award recognises emerging Australian writers and is now open for entries. If you think you've written a great unpublished fiction manuscript and you're over the age of 18, why not send it to us? Find all the details at abc.net.au/ABC Fiction Award or call 02 833 3801. The award aims to reflect our diverse Australian community. Entries close 5pm Monday, 30th of June.
Enid Blyton's books have sold over 400 million copies around the world since the 40s and 50s. They're still enormously popular. But Blyton's reputation has taken a battering among adults for some of her attitudes towards gender, race and other matters.
Tess Livingston has just written a book called Old Thatch. It's all about the house Blyton lived in the Thames Valley, where she wrote many of her books. Tess is a writer for the Australian newspaper. I think she's probably Australia's leading expert on Enid Blyton. She joins us now. Tess, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Michael.
Now, Tess, I know Old Thatch is open to visitors at certain times these days, and you've obviously been there. How does a visit to the house and the surrounding region remind you or enhance the experience of reading some of Blyton's books?
Oh, it's an enchanting house, Michael. It takes you back to your childhood where she wrote about these wonderful old houses with secret passages and chimneys. This house is on the banks of the Thames. It's more than 400 years old. It's got a thatched roof, hence the name Old Thatch, and it's got fireplaces. There's hidden treasure, I believe, buried underneath, which no one's ever been able to find.
Sounds very much like Enid Blyton territory.
It does, and it inspired a lot of her books, and it's great. It's open to the public now in the English summer over weekends and bank holidays, as they call them over there.
Yeah. I've read somewhere that Blyton herself once said she didn't listen to critics over the age of 12, which was probably very wise given the business she was in. But there have been some older critics in recent decades. And what do you say to the charge you sometimes hear that her fictional world is just too unrealistic? For example, there's this absence of adults. The children are on their own a lot, aren't they?
They are, Michael. Look, yes, it's fiction. It is unrealistic. It was probably unrealistic when she set it back in the 30s and 40s and 50s and to some degree the 60s, but fictional worlds are just that. I mean, you know, people in real life don't walk through wardrobes and land in a land called Narnia, or they don't go to a school called Hogwarts. But I think we all need a bit of escapism in our life, and this book does not in any way pretend to be a serious analysis. It's fun. It's about a wonderful area along the Thames and all the other wonderful things people can go and visit there. And if people think it's too politically incorrect, well, you know, they can go off and do what they want to do.
I've read somewhere that this month Disney has launched a cartoon series, Famous Five on the Case, that actually stars they've invented the children of the original Famous Five. I mean, I suppose that'll update the series, but it could destroy it too, couldn't it?
Look, this is going to be very controversial, and people who have the old Famous Five books are going to just shake their heads in wonder. But I believe one of the kids in the series has a shopaholic mother, and there's all sorts of modern-day problems there. But look, the company that owns the rights has the right to do this. They think it's going to be more relevant. We'll see the old Blyton books like The Faraway Tree still sell very well. And as I said, it's just a bit of fun.
Yes, I know they've rewritten some of the books too, but I think the great thing here is secondhand bookshops, isn't it? We got all the Enid Blyton books in my family from secondhand bookshops, so they were the original texts.
Mm. That's right. There's a roaring trade, actually, in original, particularly early edition Blytons. When I was writing Enid Blyton at Old Thatch, I got interested in collecting one series. It's the mystery series. That was the Five Find Outers and Dog and the hilarious Mr. Goon. That was actually set in a village called Peterswood, which is modelled on Bourne End, which is the village where Enid Blyton's house is. And there are real towns mentioned in that series. There's Marlow, that's a riverside town nearby. Taplow, where the stately mansion Clifden is, where the Profumo scandal happened, actually. And those books now, in the original form, if you get a first edition of those with a dust jacket, you're probably looking at probably anything up to £300 per book, Michael.
Crikey.
Yeah, so raid your attic.
There has been a bit of a revival, hasn't there? I mean, I think there are quite a few books about Blighton have come out recently.
Yes, Barbara Stoney has just, I think, updated her biography of Enid Blyton. There's another one that's, I think, and more of an analysis of her books that was reviewed in The Australian some time ago. And a lady rocked up to Old Thatch at the weekend and told them that she's writing a book about Enid Blyton as a businesswoman. Now, that book will be very interesting when she starts to research it, because I interviewed Enid Blyton's daughter, Gillian Baverstock, for my book. Sadly, Gillian has died recently, and she told me that, yes, while her mother, of course, made a lot of money out of the books, unfortunately, her second husband invested it where he thought was a very safe place. That was in the Rolls-Royce company, but it went broke. I know. They lost an awful lot. And years later, when Old Thatch came on the market, the daughters wanted to buy it back, but they didn't have the money to do so. So I think the book about her business dealings could be extremely interesting.
Well, especially if it extends to a family, because, I mean, these books are selling millions of copies a year still, aren't they? I mean, it's hard to see how anyone could go broke if they owned the copyright.
Oh, absolutely, Michael, yes. But look, Corian looks after it very well.
Who's Corian?
Corian is a company in London that holds the literary rights now to the Enid Blyton estate. I had to get their permission to use her famous signature on the front of my book. And yes, they're the trustees of her estate now, and they republish them and let the licences out to different companies. And fortunately, they let Connor Court use the famous Blyton signature on the front of this book about Old Thatch.
Do you think that we should just keep everything in Enid Blyton? I mean, for example, Tess, where do you stand on gollywogs?
I've got a beautiful gollywog looking at me now, Michael. I think he's a lot of fun. It's funny, my daughter is in a speaking club at her school, and she had to give a paper the other night about political correctness, and Golly came along and sat down beside her. And Golly intrigued everybody there. There's nothing wrong with a gollywog. A gollywog actually is based on a Welsh miner. Gollywogs are happy fellows who sing. I don't know why they're offensive. People love them. I mean, I just never got that whole politically correct thing.
No, I think people take them to be a derogatory depiction of black people, don't they?
Yeah, but they're really nothing to do with black people.
It's the Welsh miners. They're a derogatory depiction of Welsh miners.
Well, so someone say, but okay, the gollywogs are a bit mischievous. Even if people associate them in their minds with black people, they're lovable, they're fun, they get up to tricks. I mean, so did everyone else in the Noddy books where they appeared. You know, the monkeys were always in trouble. Tessie Bear was always in trouble. Noddy was in a fair bit of trouble himself with his silly little bell jangling on his hat. It's just good fun.
Then there was Amelia, of course.
Amelia Jane was real. Amelia Jane was a real doll. Her adventures were set in Coldmorham Lane. That's where Enid Blyton's Old Thatch house was. Amelia Jane was a doll belonging to Gillian. And that's where she wrote those stories there. And, you know, there was the pond out in the yard where she turned the fountain on and played all these tricks on the other toys and dolls in the nursery. That all happened at Old Thatch, Michael.
Yeah. Tess, I mean, my feeling is that there was a reaction against Enid Blyton in the past, but it may have calmed down a bit now. How bad did it get? Were her books actually banned in English libraries, as we often read?
They were banned in a lot of libraries, yes. I think they were. They've got them in Kensington Library in London. I had a look last time I was there.
I think it's calmed down a bit now.
It's calmed down. I think since the Harry Potter books arrived, people are taking a slightly more mature view of these things, Michael, and people are just happy these days to get kids reading anything,
that's right.
Quite frankly.
Look, we're almost out of time, but Tess, what's your favourite series? Which one would you recommend? There are so many to pick from.
Oh, my favourite is the mystery series with Mr. Goon and the Five Findouters. I think it's got so much humour. It still makes me laugh at times, and that's the one that was set in Peter's Ward, for those who remember it, and Marlowe and Taplow and all those places, as they'll find if they buy this book, were quite...
Okay. We'll have to get that. Tess, thanks very much. We're out of time, but thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
Tess Livingston is a writer for the Australian newspaper. We've been talking about her new book, Old Thatch, which is from the Australian publisher Connacourt. They're at connacourt.com. And that's just about it from us here at the Counterpoint program today.
In late breaking news, the Communist Party of St. Petersburg has urged Russians to boycott the film Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull because Cate Blanchett, in her portrayal of a KGB agent, is an insult to the Soviet and Russian people.
Well, that's it from Counterpoint this week. Definitely. The program's produced by Ian Coon. Our sound engineer today is Menny, and my name's Michael Duffy.
And I'm Paul Comrie-Jumpson. Coming up now, the Radio National News.
Listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.